Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Today, our special guest speaker is none other than David Millarc, and someone who really embodies today's theme of obtaining new life by giving new life to trees. When our speaker reached a low point in his life years ago, he received guidance that he could rescue and renew his own life by rescuing and renewing the life of the redwood forests. What have each of us learned from low points in our lives about the service that we're here to do in the world? We have the pleasure of a remarkable moderator, Samir, today. So let's start by asking him to kick off our circle. To give you some context, Samir Patel, in his career, has been a pioneer in combining data science and digital marketing. And he developed tools and platforms which have helped startup companies grow from a gleam in the eye of the founders to successful businesses that employ many people. He recently left that life, went to India to be of service at the Gandhi Ashram. And his life has been about the combination of that work and that service. So, Samir, thanks for joining us, and any opening thoughts about today's conversation?
Yeah, the opening thoughts were, just thank you, everyone, for giving me the opportunity here. And my, inspiration, for introducing David and, getting to know him, all started back, I think, Ari, when you mentioned when I was at Gandhi Ashram, when I was at a farm, and I came across this book called The Man Who Planted Trees. And, at that time, it was a very inspiring book for me. And, pretty much caused me to actually plant a lot of trees at the Gandhi Ashram. And then more recently, I came across a book by the same title by Jim Robbins called The Man Who Planted Trees, where, you see the modern day work of, David. And, I was very inspired, and I'm like, wow, this guy is living right now. And, it's kind of a legendary figure for me. So, I reached out to him and had a conversation with him, and that's how this all started. And I think the most inspiring part for me, for just the character, Jean Zeno, was that he kind of single-handedly cultivates a forest from nothing, like a barren piece of land. And just his sense of certainty, integrity, class, persistence, with a lot of love, like the work he did, and the simplicity at which he lived his daily life was truly inspiring. And I saw so much of that in David as well. A lot of us here at Service Space are, always interested in action and hands-on work in different areas, including the environment. So it would be great for you to give us an idea of just how you grew up. Like, how was your life?
Well, my life was, I was born and raised in Livonia, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit, and I was born in 1949. And so I grew up during the 50s and 60s, and I watched the transformation of Detroit, which was called the Paris of Trees back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, because the streets were so beautifully lined with large trees in Detroit. It was actually called the Paris of Trees. Huh. And ever since I was 5 years old, my father's had a nursery growing plants and trees at our home in Livonia. It was a rural area. So as soon as I was able to walk outside, I was asked to help to the weeding of the small plants and start my journey with plants and trees specifically from about the time I was 5 years old. So it's been it has been a lifestyle and not really a career. And back in those days, there was a lot of turmoil, if people remember the late 60s with the war in Vietnam and political turmoil. And there was a lot of, there were riots back then, and a lot of the young people were dissatisfied with the way of war, so it was turmoil. So I found my solace really when I was working alone as a teenager with the plants and the trees, especially the trees, and it gave me a lot of solace and a lot of time to really connect with nature. So as the craziness of the United States back in the late 60s, early 70s, and the turmoil was going on, I found my solace outdoors in the forest and with the trees and plants. And then when I was 21 years old, I moved 250 miles north because the city had gotten its tentacles into me, and I was abusing drugs. I was riding with a motorcycle gang. I was doing a lot of fighting, and I was at war with myself. So at 21 years old, I grabbed a small tent and my motorcycle. I went 250 miles north near Traverse City, Michigan, and I camped out that entire summer, something I'd never done before, trying to figure out who I was, what was going on, and what in the world, why had Creator put me on Earth? It wasn't for the negative things. What was it that I needed to do? So I camped alone on the edge of a small lake that entire summer, and by the end of that summer, I had come into my own and found out that our Mother Earth, was being abused every way that you could abuse her, in the name mostly of greed. And I was really, really sorrowful, really full of, I was angry and sorrowful, and I said, there must be something I can do to help. So I was born and raised in the suburbs of Detroit, and then moved up to a very small area, and Kokomish, by the way, is a village of 150 people.
People and trees, right? Tell me.
There's a lot of rivers and lakes and trees and forests and not many people. And it's really quite isolated, and it's very, it's rural and it's poor. It's very, very poor.
David, in your camping trip, like you mentioned, you discovered who you were. What did you discover? Like, who are you? Or not right now, but who were you at that time?
Well, at that time, I was an initiate and didn't know it at the time for my life's work and the mission that I was given before, in my opinion, before I incarnated. But first, all of us, everywhere listening, I'm sure, will agree that you have to find a quiet place and be able to listen to your inner voice and the other voices that are coming through from the divine, giving us a hint of who we are, why we were born, and what our mission might be. But if we stay busy in what I call the monkey brain chasing your tail of the cities, we're always rushing around doing things, it's difficult to listen and pay attention to who we are, why we're here, and what we could, you know, do to help. So,
yeah,
in meditation,
yeah,
that helps.
Yeah, it's a difference between being a witness and, you know, actually, you know, activity, right? So I think I agree. That makes a whole lot of sense. And, yeah, fast forwarding a little bit ahead in your, you know, to 1999, I heard you died in 1991. Is that true? If you died, you know, who are you right now? And, you know, what happened? Describe us that experience.
Well, my body died. I didn't die. But I had total renal failure, which my liver and kidneys stopped functioning. And about 3 or 4 days into that ordeal, you sort of swell up. You turn yellow. And you're very, very violently ill from the poisons that you can't get rid of, and you have high fever, and I was home, and I had two small sons, They were in single digits, 6 and 8 years old. And I refused to go to the hospital. I said, I have gotten myself into this. I will get myself out of it. I was that stubborn. And so about the fourth day, my wife, Carrie, called my best friend, Larry Roundtree. He came over and he said, you know, you're in bad shape. Looks like you're dying. You need to get some help. And he picked me up out of my bed, threw me over his shoulder, and drove me to the closest hospital. And, yes, I was in full renal failure. And there was so much fluid around my heart was stopping. And they said, you have less than 24 hours to live. We need to put you on dialysis. And we need to get the pressure from around your heart. So they take these very, very large needles with these large cylinders, and they stab them into your chest, and they draw off the fluid. So your heart, you don't have a heart attack. And that seemed to help quite a bit. And they said, well, you need a blood transfusion because your blood's not coagulating. And so they said, but probably if we do that, you'll probably hemorrhage to death. But we need to try. They were doing all kinds of things. And I was grateful for it. But when they were finished with those procedures, they said, well, you have to go on dialysis immediately, and maybe we can keep you around for 24 hours. And I said to them, no, I don't think that's what's going to happen. I said, I want to go home. And the doctor got really, really violently upset. He said, you're going to die. You can't go home. I said, no, I want to go home. So I asked them to get my friend Larry. And much to the displeasure of the hospital and the doctor, he put me back over his shoulder, put me in the car, and drove me home.
Wow.
And later on that night, and by the way, I told the doctor, I said, I'm not going to die. He said, yes, you are, and I'm happy to report that we were both correct. Later on that night, I did die. My body did, but, of course, your spirit doesn't die at all. And I left this earth plane, and I went to the next dimension. So that's how it happened.
Yeah, and tell us what happened and how that transformed, you know, your worldview, the work that you do. Because I know, like, it seems like one of the main turning points of your life was, you know, tenting out in 3 months, right? And looks like this was another kind of turning point of sorts. So, like, what did you see in that dimension that you speak of? Like, and how did that transform you?
Well, it transformed everything. Mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. It's a very, very profound experience when you actually do cross over to the other side. There's a lot of people that have near-death experiences, and they get very, very sick or very ill, or they've had accidents, but they don't actually cross over. And I haven't read any books on this, actually, and I've met a few people that have had near-death experiences, but only very few that have been through what I call the tunnel of light, Samar. And what it is when you're dying, you know, I knew that I was dying, you know, and I was full of sorrow because I had small sons. I was full of sorrow from all the people that I had misused or hurt. And I was really sorrowful that, you know, I wouldn't be around to help raise my boys. So there's guilt, there's sorrow, you're really sick, but there's not really a lot you can do. And the moment came when I lifted up out of my body in the bedroom, and much to my surprise, I was conscious. I knew who I was. I felt like I did when I was in the human body. And I started to get really afraid, like I wanted to reach back down and get back into my body. And right about then, an angel came. Really. And an angel came and said, we're here to help you. Don't be afraid. We know that you're afraid. And there was a lot of compassion and a lot of trying to, you know, comfort me. And then I was taken by the hand. And the best way I can describe it is like 10 or 12 foot diameter, literally a tunnel of light. And it didn't run up and down. It ran like more at an angle of a horizontal plane. And I went into that tunnel of light, and it was really, had a really bright white walls in the tunnel. And then on the edge of the walls, or in the walls, was like the helix of the DNA. One was a pinkish salmon-colored ribbon of light that was, you know, in the wall, and the other one was a light blue going the opposite direction. So it was a white tunnel of light with a blue and let's call it pink, lines in the walls that went on for, you know, a long ways. And so, you know, the angel was there saying, we know you're afraid. We know that, you know, but all of a sudden it was like being shot out of a cannon. And through the tunnel light we went. And I don't know how long it was.
Wow.
But the angel and I hung on tight because they knew I'd be afraid. And a little while later we arrived. Bang. It just stopped like an elevator. And I stepped out into a dimension that looked like you're overlooking, you're on the edge of a big city. But this city, the buildings were pretty much all white, and the sky was beautiful, beautiful colors, colors that I haven't even really seen on Earth. The best way I could describe it is the most beautiful sunset I've ever seen over the ocean in Florida, the Gulf of Mexico, or the most beautiful sunset you've ever seen. That's what the sky looked like. And then there was a harmonic or a feeling or wave after wave. It was unconditional love. And I'd never felt my whole being wave after wave of this unconditional love. But I could see the city, and it was really, really marvelous. The way it looked, the way I felt, the way the colors of the sky, it was like rapture. And then some more light beings came, and I thought I was going to walk over to the city, you know, walk across. It was an open area and go to the city, and I was just trying to hold on because of the wave after wave of the feeling of unconditional love and the city. It wasn't scary at all. It was the most beautiful, profound feeling and sights that I'd ever seen, and yet I was fully conscious as back when I was in my body of who I am. I hadn't lost any of that. And
wow, so all this brought you back to trees in some ways, right? So I'd love to hear more about how how do trees anchor our ability to live on this planet? Like, why trees? Like, why is that important to your work right now?
Well, trees are one of the main anchoring systems of almost every ecosystem on Earth. Not all.
What do you mean by anchoring? What do you mean by anchoring?
Well, trees, their roots grow into the ground, and sometimes very, very deeply into the ground, and yet the tops of the trees reach for the sky or the heavens. And so they are of heaven and of earth. And what I've learned in since 20-some years that I've been working with the trees is that when I came back from my near-death experience, I was sent back. They told me, you can't stay. You have to go back. You have work to do. So I was sent back through the tunnel of light back into my body, and it took me 6 weeks because I couldn't walk. But I was healing. So at that time,
yeah,
I was really
confused.
Yeah, it
sounds like, David, you haven't finished your homework. It's like, David,
yeah,
you haven't finished your homework. Go back and submit it.
And I was wondering, why did I get booted out of there, you know? But I know now that sometimes we need to go through extremes like that, Samar. And everyone that's listening, if you're in an extremely difficult situation, whether it be your physical health, your mental health, or you're in a situation with your partner or your family where you're really under duress, look at it as a blessing. I know that sounds very, very difficult to understand. But if you're being tested and challenged, know that there's important work for you to do, and it's a test.
The more
severe the test, the more important the work, it seems like.
Yeah. And I think Khalil Gibran, I think, or in the Prophet, he said that the deeper the, okay, I can't recall it the exact way, but he says basically the deeper the pain carves, the suffering carves your cup, you know, the more water it can hold, you know. So
exactly. Exactly.
That makes sense.
It makes perfect sense in my situation. And it wasn't until about, oh, I don't know, I'd say a month after I came back, I was in bed, of course, I wasn't able to walk, and I remember it was difficult even to drink water, and I lost 100 pounds during the ordeal, so I was like a skeleton. But I was able, after about a month, I was able to get out of bed and take a few steps. And it wasn't too much longer after that. It was one night, in the middle of the night, the bedroom lit up like a flash bulb had gone off in the room, a really, really bright white light. And it woke me up. It was about 2 in the morning. And actually, it kind of scared me. I said, oh, boy, are we going back? I said, maybe I'm going back, you know, through the tunnel of light again. I didn't know. And a voice said, we want you to go out in the living room and sit in your leather chair and get a yellow pad and a pen. And it was a pretty profound experience, the intensity of that light. And I said, I will if you'll turn the light down. So the lights went down to where I could take my hand off my eyes. And I worked my way out to my leather chair, and I had a yellow pad, and I sat down with a pen. And that's pretty much all I remember. But I was gone for 4 hours. And 4 hours later, when I awoke, on that yellow pad was the outline for this project. And it was about an 8-page outline. It was perfect. The spelling was perfect. Everything about it was accurate and correct. And I'm not able to do that. As luck would have it, my wife teaches English at university, and I never took university English, and she knows that I was not capable of doing that. So when she woke up that morning, she goes, what are you doing out here? And she goes, what did you write, or what are you doing? So I handed her the pad. She looked at the outline. She goes, you didn't write this, but it was in my writing. And she goes, what's going on? And I said, I don't know. And that was actually how the project came through, the outline for the project, and we're still following that outline 23 years later today, Samar.
Wow, yeah, and in the tradition, the Hindu tradition that I grew up in, you know, they kind of always talk about, you know, you being an instrument of God in some ways, and in a way that, you know, God, like you're kind of surrendering to God, and, you know, it kind of uses you as it needs to in a way that it wants to, right? And it's hard for the ego to admit to that, right? But it frees so much of our energy, and I can see that in your work, you know, relentlessly, even for all these years, you've been pretty powerful and inspiring. And I wanted to read out a quote from you from a climate scientist, and I wanted your response to it. So it's by Gus Pett. So he says that I used to think that the top environmental problems, you know, were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. And I thought 30 years of good science that we could address these, with 30 years of good science, we could address these problems. But I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to do that, we need to address the environmental problems. Now he feels that we need a spiritual and cultural transformation. So, you know, especially given the current administration hiring climate deniers, it's going to be very, very hard to, you know, for science necessarily to be enough to do the part, right? So how do you think, you know, what do you think about selfishness, greed, and apathy in the environmental revolution? And, you know, why is the spiritual important?
Well, I totally agree with that statement. But that statement has come from a higher plane. and a plane of wisdom, and it goes to the root cause that's outpicturing itself in the environmental challenges that we're having worldwide right now. But human beings have a very, very poor track record of taking care of Mother Earth. What we've been very successful in doing is taking what is a gift from God and abusing that gift for self-use, greed. It's like with the trees, or it's like with mining, or it's like with our air, or it's like with our water, it's like with our fishes. It's not just a climate science situation that we're in, but of all the kingdoms of the air, the kingdoms of the ocean, the kingdoms of the water, the kingdoms of the land, we've taken those and we've raped and adulterated those gifts in the name of money or in the name of greed. And as I say, man's greed knows no limit. There's not a certain amount that if we have $2 million stacked up and put away that we'll feel safe and comfortable and grateful. It doesn't work like that. It's endless. So if you take our fresh water, our oceans, our forests, our air, every one of our natural resources is being consumed and wasted and by greedy people, all of us, and we're taking without any thought of putting back. It's like we're entitled to misuse and to abuse the natural resources everywhere on this planet without limit. Okay.
So how would you advise us to change our lives, you know, on a daily basis? Like, what do you think we can do consciously? Because in some ways, like for me, for example, I have to drive a car because I have to get somewhere. I have to sometimes, you know, take a flight, and it's easy for me to do that. But I can see, for example, how it's affecting the planet, how it's affecting. You know, oil is causing so many wars around the world. But, you know, I still have to use it because I'm in a modern, kind of so-called modern world. So, like, how, like, for people living like us in the Silicon Valley and other places, in cities, like, what do you think we can do, still do, given we know what's going on?
Well, there's a long answer to a lot of different aspects of that question, but number one, you have to change yourself. You have to get in contact with your inner higher self, your inner being, your spiritual self, and you have to be not afraid to take a look of the way that you're leading your life, how you're leading it, what you're doing with it, how much of your life is in service to others and Mother Earth, or how much is just self-consumed and trying to stack up as much money and bring as many things for the ego's satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
The only way we can change the outpicturing of the outcome of planet Earth is by changing ourselves inside. It's and that process is a way of subjugating the ego. The ego in most of the world is in charge, and we have to learn through discipline and through positive acts of love is how to subjugate that ego to the higher will or the higher dimensions that always work with love, that always work with fairness and equity, and get control over the ego. That would be my first answer. My second answer is, I hear people say, well, David, you drive a car, you take care of planes, you know, you consume things. Yes, we do. There are new systems coming that will replace the old systems that no longer fit, that don't honor the earth or honor us. But in the meantime, if you were to go after a life of service to pay back what it is you consume or what you use, and you do that with all the earnest and all the drive that it is that you do to try and make money, if you go at it with that much resolve, you'll see that you don't have to look very far at all, and I don't care where you are. There are so many areas of people, of planet, that we could be of service to. People that have it much, much more difficult than we do right now at this time. So it's a shift in consciousness of trying to see how much, in extreme cases, how much money, how much land, how many cars, how much it would take to try and satisfy our ego, which we never can, and shift that to
shift that
to
it's
the world is in trouble, the earth is in trouble.
Yes. Yeah, so how do you, I think one of the questions for you is, how was your experience like reaching out of your own self, right? So one of the things I have, being challenged myself is, I am this Samir Patel separate from trees, right? And air and rest of the world. And every time...
No, you're not.
I'm not. But there's some illusion or there's some feeling that I am separate. And... I would love for you to comment on that. And it's not always true that I'm separate, but, I feel incredibly light and connected and powerful when I am not separate. But for most of the day, somehow, I keep going back to me. I wanted your input on just how that works for you.
Well, I think probably the biggest question for every individual that's listening to this show and every other human being that's on the planet is, who am I and why am I here? And until you can answer those questions fully with wisdom, who am I and why am I here, you're still on the quest. And ego would like us to all think that we are intelligent enough, well-educated enough, savvy enough. We don't need any help. And that's diametrically opposite of what people on the path or initiatives need. We do need help, but you have to put the ego aside and say, all right, creator, whatever the higher beings are, a belief in something that's much more powerful, divine and wise than we are, and say, okay, I've tried it my way, and it doesn't seem like I'm making much progress. In fact, in a lot of areas, I think I'm going backwards. Would you please help? So some of us are so stubborn, Samar, so darn stubborn and so full of ourselves and our ego.
Not me at all.
That the universe has to let us get to a situation where there is no way that we can help ourselves and all is lost. We are so damn stubborn, we even have to surrender our human body or our life. Then they've got your attention. It's like they say there's no atheists in foxholes. Well, depending on how stubborn you are and how the universe is always in charge, they'll let us have enough rope until we get into situations where we need to cry out and ask for help. So,
right. And I think we are at that point, right? Very soon the Keystone XL pipeline is going to be approved, right? There's massive swaths of priceless public lands open to fracking and drilling, right? We might withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord, and the climate change funding is going to be zeroed out soon, right? So I think we are in my mind, we are hitting the point with the new administration. Well, and
Well, I would say that all administrations have not done what they needed to do all along. We knew about this back in the 60s, Samar, when I was a teenager, thinking about going to college. We knew what fossil fuels were all about. We knew what the agribiz farming, using the chemicals and the sprays. We knew all this back in the 60s. And
yeah,
every administration.
Silent spring,
yes.
And a lot of those things came out, right?
Yeah. Yes. Well, we were aware of it. It wasn't just the administration. The collective will of the human family decided to go the easy route, the route that was the easiest to stack up money and satisfy the ego. So, we can't play the blame game. When you point one finger, your index finger, at someone else, if you look down, there's three fingers pointing back at you. We can't change others. We can only change ourselves. We can't blame others. We can only blame ourselves. So if we're looking for the guilty party that got us into the mess where we're at, go look in the mirror. If you want to change the situation and outpicture a more verdant, beautiful, loving planet Earth, first we have to learn how to love ourselves, we have to learn how to love each other, and we have to learn how to love our mother, which is Mother Earth, which gives us all of our wealth, all of our air, all of our food. Every single thing in the third dimension is a gift from Mother Earth. We have to become aware of that. We have to honor ourselves. We have to honor others. And especially now, Mother is asking for our help. Mother is in trouble. Okay? She's suffering. And don't ever forget, Samar, in my opinion, Mother Nature always has the last vote. So whatever it is, she needs time and place to heal. That will come about. If that means that many, many, many humans need to leave because they won't listen, they're too stubborn, they won't change their ways, they won't respect or revere themselves and others in the earth, and then a lot of people will be leaving, in my opinion. I have seen this. But it's not too late. It isn't too late. But the first thing we need to do, all of us, is remember there's help available right next door, right next to us right now. It's all the help that we need to solve all of these problems. If we'll just ask for that help and then get quiet long enough to listen to what is my role and what is it that I can do? What is it that I can do to help the grandchildren of the world to come? And when you get in that situation, you'll have a whole list of things. It'll be the busiest that you've ever been in your life, in a life of service.
So, David, I was curious about, and thanks for, you know, putting the responsibility back to each of us. And, you know, that makes me feel like I cannot just say, you know, this administration is bad, you know, this is bad, the peace summit, you know, the climate accord is not set right. It says, it kind of puts squarely me in the mirror every day and, you know, asks me, what can I do, right? And exactly. I think that sounds like something that will heal myself. You know, it will do good to me if I reduce my greed and consumption. And it will be useful to the world, right, and inspiring to the world. So, and I can see that in your own example, right? Despite all this, you know, you kept going in so many ways. So I think I had a question more around now how technology is shaping our life. So I think you've spoken at NASA before, so you know what I'm talking about is the at least the Valley and kind of most of the technology world is going towards, you know, artificial intelligence and, you know, there's Singularity University trying to figure out how man and machine can be one. There's SpaceX wanting to take people to Mars. And, you know, a lot of talk about artificial intelligence, right? And to me, I feel like there is this, you know, primitive intelligence. You know, I wouldn't call the word primitive. I wouldn't use it exactly. But what I'm trying to say there is, like, you know, kind of going back to how the natives lived, you know, how they worshipped the water and the plants and the trees and the air, and learning a lot from how they used to live and how they worship and see interconnectivity between all beings, you know, also becoming critical, right? So there's, I feel, one flow that, you know, people's heads into their phones all the time, you know, or some people building apps and websites and, you know, a lot of technology. And on another side, I feel like a back to nature pull, because it's getting overextended. So yeah, I just wanted to get your thoughts on like how you see a role for technology. You know, what are the drawbacks and kind of good things about it?
Well, what I see is there's a war going on planet Earth and other dimensions around Earth of good and evil, light and dark. That's my perspective. Okay, and the darkness would like to keep us so busy, so tied up playing with our gadgets and our gizmos and our electronics that we're too busy to take the time to explore ourselves, the all-powerful, all-wise inner beings that we are. Now, here comes a shocker for some people that might be listening. You're not your body, you're not your mind, you're not your emotions. You're an all-powerful being that's inside of a human body right now. The real you isn't your body, isn't your job, it isn't your house, and it isn't your bank account. That's the egos. That's distractions. And if you're constantly, 24 hours a day, bombarding your mind with telephones, with computers, you don't have any time to connect with your inner power or the power of nature, which really are all powerful, the power of the universe. So it's distractions. And I don't think the source of those distractions are self-empowering, loving entities. So number one, you have to turn your phone off. You have to turn your television off. You have to turn your house off and go out in nature and be still in nature and ask these questions. Who am I and why am I here? Because it's my belief, Samar, that everyone, every human being on earth, including all of those people that you mentioned, the administration and the oil industry, we're here for a purpose. Now, we can either serve the purpose of the ego, or you can be quiet and be still and listen for guidance of the mission that we were sent here to do. And usually they're diametrically opposites. All right, so that would be step number one. Turn off all the electronics, put them away, and get out to nature. Go out into the redwoods, go out into a park, go to the lake or go to the ocean and be still. And, you know, have enough courage to say, cry out, I don't know who you are. I don't know where you are. I don't know what you want of me, but could you help me, please? I need to know why I'm here. I need to know, you know, some of the mysteries of life. And if you ask and give your permission, because on planet Earth, prayer or asking is one half of the coin. The other side of the coin that most human beings that I've talked to don't know anything about is that Creator has created planet Earth as a free will planet, which means we have our own moral authority, and no one or nothing can interfere with that without our permission. So if you give your permission to the government or your boss or your job or your money, you've given your free will over to that entity. Okay? If you ask the universe, source, the light, who am I and why am I here, and I give you my permission to tell me, that clicks things into gear. If you just ask, that's half of the equation. The other secret half that most human beings really don't know about is that because it's a free will planet, we have to give our permission for them to step in and to help. So when you ask and give your permission, get set, because things will start to move. It's like a very powerful dragster where the rear wheels are up on jack stands. It has thousands of horsepower, but if the tires in the back aren't on the pavement, you're not going anywhere.
Right,
when you give the universe permission to help, because you're a free will planet being, you take that dragster off the jack stands, put it down on the blacktop, and you go like crazy. So there's one of the secrets.
Yeah.
Two of the secrets, actually.
Go ahead, yeah.
So we have to realize that we're not our bodies. You know, we're not our houses. We're not our jobs. And we have no bosses other than what we give our free will to, whether it be, you know, the place where you work or wherever that is. But if we get quiet and we reach out to the divine and say, I need some help, I need guidance, and I give you my permission to start working with me, things start to change very, very quickly.
Yeah. Wow. No, this is very inspiring and personally very touching for me to hear this from you. So, you know, definitely very charged up. I think the other question I had was more around, let's talk about action a bit, right? For people who understand certain things, for example, let's say I get to know work Archangel does, or you know, any environmental problem. So I learn about it, then I get inspired, right? And then the third step is turn my intention and inspiration into action. And I found that there is a huge chasm, right? A gap between one getting inspired and one actually acting on it.
So, most people confuse activity or movement with progress, and it isn't.
Frenetic
activity is not progress.
You know, because sometimes you get into the habit of, you know, getting inspiration, you know, from everywhere, but then it doesn't transform into action. So what can help us, and you know, everybody who is listening, to bridge that chasm between you know, action. So between inspiration and action.
Well, every single human being that I know, in that person's soul or heart of hearts, some people love animals. Some people love children. Some people love being of service to the elderly. We have a love in our hearts for something that has a deep meaning to us. Some of it, it's the oceans and the preservation of the mammals in the oceans. Some people are just absolutely bonkers over water quality. They're just, you know, their passion is to try and make clean, fresh water wherever it is on Earth available to the women and children and people that live there. So first, you take a little self-examination of what's really important to you. What really resonates with you? What would you like to set your hand to, and your action, you know, the sweat of your brow, to change, to make it a little bit better? Well, in my case, it was trees. And in the case of Archangel Ancient Trees, we have a website. I would really encourage everyone to go to our website. It's archangelancienttrees.org, and take a look at some of the films of we're cloning the world's largest and oldest trees. Trees that are thousands and thousands of years old. For the first time, we have been successful, where others have failed that I know of everywhere on Earth. We're the first to be able to clone the largest and oldest trees on this planet, reproduce them out, and it's on our website, make millions of these trees and start to reforest the planet. For example, Samar, 98% of the old growth forests in the United States are gone. We cut them down, we killed them. Okay, only 2% of our old growth forests remain. We didn't even study those trees before we butchered them all for firewood, for boards, for hot tubs, or whatever, for money. We didn't know what they did for the quality of all life on Earth, for water quality, for air quality, for quality of providing shade. Now there's new science in Jim Robbins' book, The Man Who Planted Trees. And by the way, Jim was a New York Times, Science Times reporter for 25 years. He followed us around as we were cloning some of the largest, oldest trees on the planet, and said, why is this important? And then he called 100 scientists, leading scientists around the world, and saying, what's new? What do we know about trees now that we didn't know 10 years ago or 20 years ago? And so he wrote this book that it's a fascinating book of the new science of what trees and what roles they play for all living things on Earth. Like, we know now, there's several new books out, trees talk to each other. Number one, we could prove that they talk to all the other trees, not only in the forest, but at great distances. Number two, we know that they feel and register pain, and they express that pain, and other trees pick it up. There's hard science to prove that. So every tree that we cut down felt the pain, expressed that pain, and cried out, and the other trees in the area picked it up. We just didn't cut down a dumb chunk of wood. It had no feelings, no emotion, no nothing. And we stacked it up and made boards. Every tree that gets cut down today feels the pain, expresses it, and cries out. There's new science to prove that. We also have new science that's in Jim Robbins' book about the aerosols, the critically important aerosols that come out of the needles and the leaves of trees. that prevent endemic diseases from going all over the planet. There's 450 new diseases running rampant around the planet because our first line of defense, the aerosols of the trees, that negate or kill the pathogens that are in the air, we've taken down. So the aerosols that keep us healthy, that keep our animals healthy, the aerosols that help fight cancers. It's like there's great promise in Jim's book with black walnuts that if our young girls will take a leaf off of black walnut and rub it on their wrists, there are chemicals in the black walnut that show great promise for breast cancer in girls, preventing breast cancer. Okay, also, if we would have left the black walnuts up in this country and around the world instead of making furniture out of them, we now know that if the young girls would breathe in those aerosols from the walnuts, it would go a long way in preventing any cancers in our girls. But yes, we have a bunch of pretty furniture. We cut all those trees down and agreed to make the furniture in large part, and we took away the aerosols that would help protect our girls from those hideous cancers that they're now experiencing. So I highly recommend everyone that's listening to get Jim Robbins' book and read it and understand more of the latest science of the roles that trees play for all of us. That would be one of the very first things that I do. And then go to our website if you want to help. Right now we have one of the largest projects that we've ever had undertaken. We did it we stepped on in phase, Samar. We're planting 26 different communities around the Puget Sound area. Mm-hmm, we're reestablishing the redwood forest in 26 different communities. It's a pretty ambitious project.
Yeah.
A very, very expensive project. And by the way, Archangel Ancient Trees gives away all the clones of the biggest, oldest trees that we produce. We give them away to whoever it is or whatever organization or community is in hopes in return you would help support our federally recognized nonprofit. So all the work that we do, we give the results of the trees away, and we would just hope and pray that you would see the value of it and help support our nonprofits. If you go to our website, you're into trees, you're into doing something wonderful and beautiful for your community, your city, your school, your temple, whatever it is, go to our website, and it won't be very long. You'll see there are a lot of things that you can take action in right now, today, and do. And
yeah,
I'm sure that's...
Yeah, and I would second the opinion of the book, actually, because I've read it cover to cover, and, it's kind of the best gift you could give yourself and your kids, or read it out to them. It's very, very easy read, but it's very, like, as David said, it's not... It's scientific, but not overly technical in a sort of way. So it's kind of normal human beings can understand why trees matter. And with going enough detail to the next level, rather than just saying, like, hey, protect trees and plant more trees. So I would highly, highly recommend that read.
We had a comment mailed in from Mish Rosen in New York. And she says, David, every trial by fire has grown my heart, thus enabling me to feel more love for others, and I believe has revealed my life mission to be an encourager of others. It's a simple mission, took me so long to realize the worth of being an encourager, realize my self-worth, and stop comparing myself to others. I know it's the reason I chose to return here, because it's so easy for me to do, seems to help others constantly, and is such a gift to me. Without my sufferings, would never have realized any of this. Grateful for my suffering, going through another trial right now and looking forward to new growth coming. Everything David shares resonates deeply. Love you, David. I aspire to be a giver.
Well, I happen to think that's 110% truth. It's from a higher wisdom. And I know that the way through our challenges, our suffering. It builds character. It's sort of like initiation for a higher work that we won't quit. We'll keep going no matter what the circumstances are. And going through it is pretty darn tough because we're humans. But I guarantee if you persevere and don't quit and you reach out in our sufferings, we reach out because we run out of answers. There's nothing else the doctors can help us with. There's nothing else we can do. So at that point, we're malleable. At that point, we open our hearts and our higher wisdom, and the divine comes into our hearts and says, okay, we're here to help you now. So take heart in your suffering. And whoever that woman is, I think it's one of the most beautiful things that I've ever heard read to me, and it seems 1,000% accurate.
Beautiful. You know, Samir, I'm thinking of the saying from Khalil Gibran that you were mentioning earlier, something about the deeper the cup, the more that it can hold. I suspect that many other traditions reflect that same wisdom. In my tradition, in Jewish mysticism, there's a saying that the brightest sparks of light are hidden in the darkest places. The same thing.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that. I didn't know that.
There's a lot of truth in that.
You know, it seems to come out, right, in many, many forms of wisdom. I want to ask you something, David. You know, you've talked about the work of Ancient Tree Archive, and you talked earlier about your going through the Tunnel of Light. I'm sort of interested in that transition. You know, once you emerge out of your journey through the Tunnel of Light and you're realizing your purpose in the world, how did the Archangel Tree Archive get started?
Well, once you come back, you realize that you value life because, number one, you know that your life here has a length of time, that it's not limitless, so you really value every day. Every day is a gift. It really is, and that's one of the most profound first things that happens. Say, wow, you know, just a little bit of time and chance, and I would not be here, but I am here today, and I really, really appreciate my family. I appreciate nature. I appreciate beauty. Whatever it is, you know, you've been through, like, this can leave any second now. I better appreciate it for what it is now because this is a limited time that we have here this time. So there's that, and then it does something to your heart. It opens your heart to allow love to come in and through us. I don't think ourselves, you know, we're capable of love, but I think love loves through us. So it opens up that shutdown portal of our heart, you know, that's so busy, entrenched in the ways of this world. It opens it up to the beauty and love of the divine. And once your heart is filled with that, it spills out to those around you, and it gives you a whole different perspective on why you're here and what really is important. You know, what really is important is if you take the time to tell someone in your family, you know what, I really love you. If you take the time to do something kind to an animal, if you take time, just a brief moment, to see the beauty of a sunset or a flower, or it's the little things that love spills out in many ways. I used to be an avid deer hunter. I would not hunt anymore for love nor money. I have no desire to be a hunter. But I do like to help the deer. I like to bring some hay out to them once in a while and corn and things. And everything changes. Your whole perspective changes. It takes the emphasis off the I or the me, and it puts it out into the other kingdoms, the rest of the world. So it's a pretty profound shift, especially for males, I would imagine. And you have to learn how to navigate in a world filled with love and compassion and giving. And it's all new territory for most of us. And then you come in contact with your feminine side. you learn to appreciate the power in femininity, the beauty in femininity, Mother Earth. There's many changes that you have to learn how to deal with pretty quickly because most everything has changed. That was my experience.
Yeah. You know, looking on the Archangel Tree Archive website, it looks like there are a few other people there with your last name. So I'm imagining that maybe they're your kids, your sons, daughter-in-law, whatever. Can you say a little bit about this family enterprise and what it's like having your family involved?
Well, where we live in Kokmish, we live on the family land. And our grandchildren that live on this piece of land are the sixth generation here on this land. So every day we have an exchange and communication with the grandparents, the parents, the children, and the grandchildren. It's a dynamic. And it's a real give-and-take situation. And so as I changed and as more and more of the world came to say, hey, what you're doing is important. I don't like the way it looks where I live. They've cut all the trees down. It's hot. The air is polluted. We're worried about our water. Could you come and help us here? So far, we've heard that call from 147 countries.
Wow.
People from 147 different countries said, David, could you come and help us here? Could you clone our old trees? Could you help us reforest our area? And then every year, we're told that we reach about 200 or 300 million people worldwide. And pretty much everyone from the same, you know, from all the countries are afraid. They're fearful. They're fearful of the future for fill in the blanks, environmental reasons, reasons of war, reasons of politics. They're fearful. And they're looking for something positive to do. Something that they're capable of doing. You know, you don't have to have your PhD or you don't have to be a skilled tradesman. Something you can do with your kids or with your partner or with your pets or whatever is go plant a few trees. And you'll be amazed. You'll be amazed what that does for you and others around you when you take the time to go do something that will help the earth. Help all the kingdoms of the earth, the animal kingdom, the plant kingdoms, to clean the water and the air and give back in service. You don't have to have very many skills to learn how to run a shovel. And you have to make sure and nurture that tree for a couple of years with water every week. And so it takes the emphasis off of I and puts it where it belongs into giving back to Mother Earth. In all of our kingdoms. So,
beautiful.
And I had a quick quote on this. I got a chance to meet Wangari Maathai, who is a Nobel laureate. And she has a quote called, "Until you dig a hole, you plant a tree, you water it and make it survive, you haven't done a thing. You're just talking."
Yes. And you know what? The whole world is talking. The whole world is studying. World is texting.
We have a few callers in the queue, so I'd like to start getting to some of them.
Hi, this is Wendy in Half Moon Bay, and thank you so much for this call so far. I really feel like I'm getting some vitamins today. And first of all, I do love your idea of giving permission when you're asking for help. That's something I hadn't really thought about, and that does feel like an important piece. So I do plan to implement that into my practice. So thank you for that very practical suggestion. When I was looking at the write-up here on you, there's one thing that kind of caught my eye, and it was talking when they said the era of preservation is over, but now we're entering the millennium of restoration, and I was wondering how you made that shift. And just the last thing I just wanted to say is just a little plug for those of us who have gardens and who are planting trees in our gardens. We may not be going out into the forest, but we're still trying to do our part in our gardens by planting trees as well. Thank you.
Thank you. That was very. I've been to Half Moon Bay many, many times over the last 25 years. I really like that place. And I was fortunate enough 3 or 4 years ago to be asked to speak at Google World Headquarters in Silicon Valley or some big place like that. And one of the things that I asked, there was a crowd of several thousand there, is I pointed out that Silicon Valley is right dead center in the middle of the old growth redwood forest. So when you left the building and you drove around Silicon Valley, you were actually driving around in an old growth redwood forest. That's what it looked like for thousands and thousands of years. It looks the way it does today because of man's intervention. So I asked for volunteers. I said, please, we have clones of the world's largest and oldest redwoods. We have the ways and the means. I need help. Let's start to reestablish the redwood old growth forest here in Silicon Valley, and let's put back. You know, that doesn't mean we all have to pack up and leave or shut our buildings down, but let's start to rebuild the old growth redwood forest that was here for thousands of years. And I'll ask you to do the same thing. Half Moon Bay is a perfect place for growing redwoods along the ocean, so maybe you'd like to go to our website and investigate, how could I plant my little patch or my little grove of redwoods that for the next 2,000 years, day and night, 24/7, will be helping with the water, the air, shelter, shade, so it'll be paying it forward for 2,000 years if I develop a little grove in my backyard. That would be my challenge to you, to take a look at that and perhaps answer that call.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
David, I so much want to thank you for the really core spiritual approach that you're taking to all of this. When you responded to Samir about, you know, well, I have a car to drive and all that stuff, and you said, well, you'll know what to do and how to deal with that if you do your inner work, your inner journey. And
yes.
That was such a powerful statement. I almost was crying when you said that. And I think what that reminded me of was the concept of story and how culture communicates to its children and to all the members in society through stories. And the story that we've been telling for a long, long time in many societies is about building fences to protect our own possessions, because the story says we need to protect ourselves from hardship in order to live a good life, right? And the story focuses on our own survival rather than the survival of our greater personhood, which is our world community, and the survival of a larger world. And I'm just wondering what it would be like if we started telling a new story about finding strength and satisfaction and our sense of security in a willingness to see service and hard work and challenge as an opportunity to find our true self-worth and our satisfaction, right?
I think that the riches and the abundance in your life in many ways would be so profound you would wonder why you ever hesitated. Doing exactly that, because as we all know, there is really no protection and there's really no soul satisfaction in stacking up money and seeing how much we can stack it up to try and protect ourselves.
Yeah.
Or stack it up to compare egos with, I have more money than you do. Is it really soul satisfying? I think not.
Yeah.
Are five cars really necessary for our safety and to make us feel good? You can have no car, and you could be relying on benevolence of others for transportation or whatever, and you can be absolutely soul satisfied. So if we look for our happiness outside of ourselves in objects or things, you're looking in the wrong place, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The place where all the beauty emanates from is from within, and we're all connected, all of us, all in nature, we're all connected. So whatever we do for ourselves, it's a matter of putting a toothpick in the bird feeder so a bee can land on the toothpick to get a drink of water. If it gets hotter, why not help the bees? Just give them a place to land in the bird bath. It's small things. It's taking time to smile at someone instead of walking through a crowd stone-faced and have all these walls up and pretend that we don't notice anything. Just stop and say, hello, how's your day going? Just take a moment in our humanness to express a little bit of interest in someone else or something else. That's where we begin.
Here's a note, email from Sarasota, Florida. It looks like it's from Dorsey. And the question is, so are your trees being planted on private and or public lands? And how does that contact come about? I know you've spoken a little bit about that, David. Anything further you'd like to say in response to this question?
Yes. First and foremost, you need to plant the trees that are native trees to your area, wherever you're listing, whatever country, whatever part of this country, whatever region you're in. What you need to do is look for the biggest, strongest, best native trees that were the native forests that got cut down and start to put them back. Redwoods aren't for everyone everywhere, but they happen to be the most iconic, beloved tree in the world. But Archangel has worked with over 120 different tree species from all over the United States and now Ireland. We have cloned 1,000-year-old oak trees that were thought to be lost in Ireland, made several hundred copies, and gave them to the people of Ireland and say, okay, it's time for you to start to reestablish your old-growth forests here in Ireland. We hope to do so with funding in the U.K. We have a huge project underway in Southern California in the Sierra Nevadas with giant sequoias. But wherever you're listening, whatever city, whatever state, whatever country, it's the native trees that were there for hundreds of thousands of years of where you're listening. That's the trees that you need to put back. So it isn't just redwoods. Now, last year at this time in Sarasota, we stayed in Siesta Key, and we were asked to try and clone a 3,000-year-old cypress that was only one or two of these ancient cypress were in Florida. My son Jake climbed them. The 3,000-year-old cypress, I'm sad to say, a person with a drug problem burnt that tree down. And so we cloned a 2,000-year-old cypress to make cypress available to start to put back the cypress forest, the great cypress forest of Florida. But I would ask everyone listening to please go to our website, look at the videos, look at our work, write us. You can write us at our website. We answer everyone. I see everyone that writes into our website. And if spirit moves you, if you're in the position and you feel like it was something financially you'd like to try and help our work, we need your help now more than ever. We've stepped out on faith in some big projects. We just made 15,000 more redwoods and giant sequoias on faith. We're being asked from countries all over the world to please bring our technology and our message and our hands-on way of doing things. We have a new tree school to teach all children K through 12 how to do their own trees, how to do it in their classroom, how to do what we do and bring it right into their classroom and their homes. We'd like to kick off tree school around the world for the young people. We have our needs. It's a little, you know, it's difficult for me to ask, but I'm asking if you could help. You go to our website, it should be easy, and I guarantee you it will pay dividends.
Awesome. And we're going to make sure that we include that in the email that's going to go out to everyone. We have one last question in the queue.
Hi, David. My name is Koza. I'm calling in from Cupertino, California, and thank you so much for sharing your story and your guidance. It occurred to me when you're talking about how trees feel pain when they're cut down or when they're injured, that, you know, trees like us have a soul, and
yes,
a lot of us are meditators here, and I was thinking one day that, like, the best meditators in the world are trees, you know, because they sit for thousands of years, right? And they withstand storm, they withstand heat, and they just sit, and they're still, and they're in stillness. And they truly are our elders. If you know, you're talking about 2,000, 3,000-year-old trees, they're our elders. And I'm wondering if you get that sense working with these trees that, in a sense, they're our spiritual elders, and if you've had any communications or any guidance from them in that manner?
Yes and yes. We've had newspaper reporters from all over the world, magazines, television shows, that would like to do stories on us. We've had 8 feature stories in the New York Times. You know, we're blessed there. And I say to everyone that when you go and spend a couple, 3 days in an old-world forest with us, you'll come out of that forest different than when you went in, because if you spend time in old-world forest, those trees do affect our physical bodies, our mental bodies, and especially our spiritual bodies. Redwoods have been on this planet for 400 million years longer than humans. I believe that trees have a soul and they have a consciousness. And I do believe that anyone and everyone can learn to communicate with those trees. They would love to help you with some of the answers of some of the questions, because I think they are definitely divine beings. That's my own personal experience. I know that might shock some people, but I think the more time that you spend in the forest, and especially old growth forest, you'll have some revelations and you'll have some physical healings. I believe that they also, it's just a tremendous way to get our nervous systems back together, as well as some of our physical challenges. So I'd encourage everyone to put your phone away, turn the TV off, get out of the car and go spend some time in the old growth forest for your sake, for your mental and physical health.
Great. Thank you, Kozo. David, we traditionally have a final question that we ask our guests, and I think you've already answered it on one level, so I want to ask if you have any further thoughts, maybe on another level. And that question is, how can we, all of us here as a community, support you and your work?
Well, you support us in our work by stopping and taking a look at trees and all the wonderful things they do for all kingdoms in a different lens. And then back that support by taking your children or your friends or your lover, whoever that is, give back to Mother Earth and pay it forward for the future.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.